Welcome to the FutureCast, the Institute for the Future's ongoing conversation about signals of emerging innovations and disruptions that will make the future.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the fifth FutureCast, IFTF's monthly podcast. Today is August 12, 2010, and I'm Jerry Mikulski, your host. With me virtually are several senior IFTFers, Kathy Vian and Jaime Cassio, David Evan Harris, as well as our guest, Cesar Harada, with whom we will be talking in just a moment. We will hold these calls monthly, and we'll post the podcast to iTunes and the IFTF site. Our live chat is actually on Twitter with the hashtag FutureCast. Please feel free to forward information about these calls to anybody you think might be interested. And also one last request, when you jump into the conversation, please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's call is about learning to live on the oceans, and our guest is Cesar Harada, who is a TED Fellow and was also at the MIT Sensible Cities Lab, and has now sort of dived into the real world to try to solve real problems, which is what we're trying to focus on in these calls. So, Cesar, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the call. It would be lovely to know what got you interested in open sailing, and how did it? What is, in some sense, the birth story behind open sailing? How did you arrive at wanting to do this?
Open sailing is not only me, so it's not only me diving in the subject, but it's a group of people. Mm-hmm. I've always been passionate about sailing, but somehow I always try to do unrelated project, but it always ended up being somehow on the water. So Open Sailing as the organization trying to put together the International Ocean Station started at the Royal College of Arts in London. So we had a brief at the Royal College of Arts about mind control. So how do you actually use people's psychology to control them? And I was interested mostly in how politics have been using fear as a means to manipulate people to do them most of the time bad things during the war, etc. But I was trying to see how you could actually use people's fear to make them do something good. So starting in this direction, then step by step, we started to approach the subject of the where would be more desirable to live and where would be the safest place to live on Earth instead of, waging for war. And we ended up saying that the sea, if we were building this kind of new contraption of devices, would be a safe place. I mean, of course, the sea has lots of problems with the wave, the wind, and very unpredictable weather pattern, but still there is a lot of resource, energy, food sources. So this is how the interest started.
Mm-hmm. And was the group, the International Ocean Station, already in progress, or were you part of the formative group? How did that come together?
So originally, the initiative was really trying to we were just a small group of people, and we were interested in life at sea, just in general, and how you'd be living in the sea. But very very quickly, when you study the technology for living at sea, you can see that almost everything has been figured out in terms of water purification, finding nutrients, producing your own energy in the sea. A lot of that stuff has been figured out. So the idea is that our effort was more to put these technologies together in a more meaningful and efficient way. But when you see that all this technology exists, then you ask yourself, why are you going to be in the sea? You're not going to be there just to hang out. There's so many things you actually have to be doing in the sea in terms of research, exploration. So this is how the project very quickly, maybe in the course of 3 weeks, transformed from life at sea project to more like exploration and scientific research project.
Mm-hmm. And what is the relationship between the International Ocean Station and the Open Sailing Project?
So Open Sailing is, I'm in the process of making this. We're in the process of making this into a non-profit organization. So it's more like a social framework. So it's just a flagship. And the International Ocean Station is an artifact. So it's one of the things that Open Sailing is doing, because Open Sailing is developing several technologies, and the International Ocean Station, if you will, is like a concentrate of all the findings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent. So, and you think of the International Ocean Station sort of as a parallel to the International Space Station? That's the metaphor you're working with, right?
Absolutely. I think it's more than a metaphor. I mean, it's more than just, you know, like taking inspiration or it. I mean, we have the International Space Station. It's a very useful and relevant structure that permits, you know, because you have a lot of power on board, so you can have unprecedented research happening in there. And so yes, the International Ocean Station has a lot in common. So the idea is to create an open source platform to enable collaborative research in the ocean.
Very interesting. And it just happens that I spent the last day and a half at the Singularity University down in Mountain View, and mm-hmm. The last segment of it was all about space travel, but we also talked quite a bit about the parallels between space travel and undersea life. I don't know if you know Sarah Jane Pell.
Yes.
she's a deep sea diver. Oh, that's right. You're co-TED fellows.
She's a friend of mine, yeah.
Exactly. And that's right, because I mentioned our call to Sarah, and she said, oh, that's right. That's great. And it was really interesting to hear them talking a bit about the parallels between sustaining life in space and sustaining life underwater. In their case, they weren't talking so much about on the surface.
Absolutely. So Sarah, just to detail what she's doing, so Sarah Pelgen is Jane. So she's doing the her project is the project she's participating is very similar to Open Cenobites under the water. So it's a community of scuba divers, and they're going to be doing this. I don't know if I'm actually allowed to speak about it, but I mean they're doing the same kind of thing but under the water.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we work together at some point.
Yep. So yep. Also, you call this project Open Sailing, and I think there's a very big emphasis on making everything about it open, open source, open content, and I think open process.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe how you're opening this up and what it means to you to have it be open?
Okay, there's lots of, I was having this discussion with Professor Masuduchi, who is the emeritus professor at MIT Ocean Engineering, and he was telling me that the ocean is the next frontier. So he was telling me that, I mean, he was actually the chief engineer welder for the spaceship that went on the moon. So he knew very well that what are the constraints for the space, and he was telling me that the space is much easier than the ocean because the space is cold, empty, and predictable, but the ocean is wild, violent, and the forces are much stronger. Like the impact of a wave, the wind of a hurricane, it's much more complicated to deal with than, you know, like the temperature of the space. Mm-hmm. So he was telling me that the next frontier is the ocean, and my feeling is that if it's a space that we can not conquer in a very aggressive, phallic way of conquering the ocean, but I thought maybe if we can study and understand the ocean better in a more pacific and more open way, maybe it's better. And also if you do open source, then countries which are usually don't have access to space exploration or ocean exploration, they could actually participate even with less money.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
So in some sense, we sort of have to seduce our way into living on the ocean. We have to consider it a research project and figure out how the different piece parts fit together, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a research project, but ultimately, like, I really want to not emphasize on the lifestyle because I think it would be very vain to say, hey, everybody, go to the water if the technology is not ready. Many people would die. Like, this is what happened when you know, like, at the beginning of aviation, when they said, I mean, when they started inventing planes, they didn't say, hey, let's all live in the air. I mean, people said that, but not the engineer, not the people actually working on technology. The romancer, the sci-fi writer were talking about, like, cities in the sky and stuff like this, but not the people actually doing the work. So I really don't want to be in the categories of romances. I really want to be I am in the people who actually work on the technology on a daily basis. So trying to be more pragmatic and, you know, find technical solutions.
Cool. And can you just outline some of the different areas of investigation? I mean, I imagine it's food, energy, water, and other sorts of things. But what are the major ways that each of those are being addressed nowadays? And you said earlier that some solutions have already become available for doing this. What are the things that work?
So, okay, when we started the theoretical research, we used a very simple analogy. So it's an analogy with biology. So every living organism needs to have six basic functions, like sensing, moving, excreting, reproducing, and I think there's some kind of communication as well. But there are six functions, which are the basic vital functions of any living organism. So that's a bit caricatural, but that was a starting point, if you will, for determining in which how we would structure our research. So these six senses, not senses, but like capacity of the living organism, were like how we aiming at dividing our groups in order to have like an inter-laboratory symbiotic research dynamic. Because when you're producing food, you need to have like a structure, so like not bones or skin, but you need to have like some kind of habitat. When if you're producing energy, then you need energy for all of the other applications. So it's a very intricate collaboration between the labs. So this is how we're looking at dividing our activities.
Mm-hmm. And so do you want to just take one of those and unpack it for us? Just open it up.
I just didn't prepare. I don't know which one I should unpack.
The one you're most interested in or have done the most work in, whether it's energy or movement or something else. Just
maybe
so you can have a taste of what the research insights are.
So maybe I could speak about the general structure engineering. So we made a research on what we call instinctive architecture. So the idea of instinctive architecture is constituted into a lab. So the idea is to find shapes which are motion steady, but which can also move. Basically, you have boats which are very good to commute from a point A to a point B. So like all oceanographic laboratories have today, they have these big metallic boats and they go in the ocean and many of them, they send in the water gliders and stuff. So it's good for commuting from A to point B. And you have oil platforms, so they're very, very static. But you see sometimes they're not as safe as we think they are. And so we need something in between, basically. We need something that is able to, like a petrol platform, stay, but also being able to move from point A to point B to if you need to change research field. So this is this area we've been looking at, and inventing these kind of drifting structures. So most of the time they're flexible and they are low cost. Ideally, these are floating labs, basically. So mm-hmm. That's what we're looking at.
And you just said drifting structures?
Yes, drifting. Basically, drifting isn't exactly describing what it does because it's not constantly drifting, but the idea is that it can sail or it can motor and it can also be very static, very stable to enable research on board.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so some of the way, you can move organically with the tides and currents, or you can use wind or other kinds of power to keep yourself on station, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And the shapes that are ocean steady and move are, I think, what you're designing is relatively organic, so that they're basically shapes that can be configured and reconfigured and, in fact, can shrink. In bad weather, you can sort of pull in the different tentacles or the different devices that are doing things for the lab, and then when everything is in good and calm weather, you can redeploy them. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct. So imagine if there's a storm, you really don't want to have too much equipment spread out because they might just end up colliding on your home structure, if you like. But if the weather is good, maybe you can actually have a lot more a surface that you inhabit and use for cultivation or energy energy retrieval. So the structure and time will change according to the weather. And I think this is really a natural way of behaving when you're in the ocean. It's like almost body language. When just to explain it, it's really like an everyday language, but you want to adapt to environments more than have one strong structure that doesn't change and will eventually get broken.
That makes sense. And also, in sailing, you refin your sail when you get bad weather, so you present less surface to the storm, so you don't get beaten about as much. And here you're in some sense you're reefing the living surface back in, so that it becomes safer, more stable in the storm. It's very interesting.
That is, that strength is not the, the strongest way. Like, if you want to, you cannot resist the impact of real waves. They are so huge, like no boats can actually cope with them. So you need to be very flexible and very light.
And what do you do for people inside those spaces? Do they, can you isolate people from the wave motion in different ways, or do people just learn to live with the wave action?
No, you definitely want to minimize the tilt that the people will have to be enduring, just for the people, but also for the equipment. I mean, if you have a microscope and you need to study samples, you need to have a very stable, steady table. So there are lots of options. I mean, in the absolute physics, if you will, there is two main shapes which are absolutely C-steady. So there's the sphere and the stick, vertical stick, because they're always exposed to the ocean motion, the same surface, the wet surface, which we call this wet surface. So basically the surface is touching the water, because in any wave shape, if the buoyancy stays the same, then the surface touching the device is going to be the same. So basically a stick and a sphere is the shape of a buoy. So if you put a lot of weight at the bottom, then you get something stable. So boat is definitely not a buoy. So we're looking at this kind of intermediary shape and flexible structure to enable a capacity to take the beating of the waves and absorb the beating to protect the people inside. As well, like having like a Russian adults, like you have many doors within the doors, is one of the options we're looking at, to have consecutive shells. So one shell will absorb lots of shock from the outside, and the second shell, third shell will be more stable.
Right, interesting. And also, while absorbing a beating, you could also be generating a lot of energy, right? Because some of the devices that you're looking into actually use wave action and wind action, and sometimes multiple, tidal action, sometimes all sorts of different energies to create energy, motions, forces to create energy, right?
That's correct. So, for example, if I was talking about shells, so imagine you have just to give a little mind experiment, you have a sphere, and you have consecutive shells. So the first shell outside is isolated from the second and first. So when the wave hits the first shell, it compresses the outer chamber, if you like, and you can easily activate some turbines out of this. And if there's a bit of memory shape inside the outer sphere, it will just come back to its sphere shape and then reinflate and eventually would be pressed again. So, we're really looking at alternative ways of generating energy. So one of the last experiments was called the energy animal. So it's a device that makes energy from the waves, the wind, and the sun, so at the same time. So it was a kind of a new type of electric generator, and it would go where there's more energy, so where there's more wind or sun or waves, also where there's more demand, so where there's more concentration of population. So not only generating energy in a new way, but using different new ways, so hybrid energy, and also more in accordance of what we call microgrids. So like to actually generate energy more locally or for a specific need.
Sorry, micro what?
Microgrids.
Microgrids, okay.
Yes.
So like the power grid.
Yes, the power grid, but you have big power grids, like nuclear power plants and the power thousands of houses. What if we had, small energy generators? We would lose less energy on the network and we will have less risk, and we create more employment and have a more probably reliable grid. So it doesn't mean that we have to replace or completely the grid. It's just, it would make us save a lot of energy.
Interesting. Okay. And let me ask one more question, then start inviting Kathy and the crew in to ask questions, which is, what is the timeline that you see for all of this? For example, the energy animal, is it an idea? Is it actually a CAD spec? Has anybody tried to prototype it, and how long might that piece take to get into operation? And then fitting that inside the various other projects, is this a, do you see this as a 5-year project, a 20-year project? What's your sense of the timing of all these things?
So maybe you know it took more than 25 years to build the International Space Station, more than 25 years, and more than $150 billion for like the top countries and the best rocket scientists in the world. What we hope is that using open source technology, we should be able to make this open this international ocean stations, several of them, on a much more short timeline. So we think about just a couple of years. So for example, the Energy Animal we already made one prototype which is working. It's not competitive, which means it doesn't produce more energy than a green meal or a classical solar panel, but it's already prototyped and it's already tested. So our approach is really step by step and really iterative process. So it's a lot from the DIY culture and the tinkering mentality. Mm-hmm. So we have ideas, and instead of waiting in the lab for too many months, we just prototype them really quickly, even quick and dirty, it doesn't matter. We try it out and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, then we just take another direction. But so the International Ocean Station ideally would be, I moved to the Gulf of Mexico because we have the North American continent's worst environmental tragedy, which just happened, which is the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we can have something which is the beginning of the International Ocean Station floating in the Gulf of Mexico. I hope by, if not the end of the winter of this year, of 2010 wow. or early 2011, but maybe it's just a small floating lab, you know, for the moment. It's probably not a big structure, but it's probably just a small floating lab with some measurement equipment. But it's the beginning of prototyping the bigger one.
Right. And there are, I mean, there's a variety of activities on the oceans of different kinds. Mostly it's people crossing the oceans, not so much living on them. But there are a lot of different interesting smaller things all the way down to Spiral Island, which is not seaworthy at all. But it's really an interesting approach to living on a man-made island in the inland waterways where there's no heavy weather or wave action, but still doing something different.
Spiral Island is a very, very good example of what a community can do with a very simple technology. It's really amazing. Like they build this island out of plastic bottles, mm-hmm. and it's very, very inspiring. Like you can see like people really... You know, they can just empower themselves and just go out and invent a new way. But now it's very different objectives. So they're also creating really a new lifestyle with this ecologic mentality. It's a very different objective. We're really focusing on the research, environmental sensing and stuff like this.
So in some interesting way, this is kind of a spin-off of the permaculture movement also. I'm going to coin a bad phrase, perma-aquaculture. It's you know, living sustainably on the water, mm-hmm. which adds a whole lot of complexity and interesting angles to it. Let me invite Cassie and Jamie and David into the call. Do any of you have questions you'd like to ask?
This is Kathy, and Jerry, I think probably we need to get out of lecture mode if we want to invite more people into the call.
Sure, Maureen, if you want to open up the mics, that'll help us.
Okay. And this is fascinating, and I have lots of questions. I'm trying to figure out which one to go with first. One of the questions that obviously came up for me is, you know, if this is successful at sea and we start creating, you know, using these new structures at sea, it's really a new vision for a built environment that's designed for the sea as opposed to for land. Do you see a feedback system into our land-based built structures? What do you imagine for the cities of the future when we can look out to sea and see these kinds of structures that you're talking about?
Yeah. So again, like I'm not an advocate of lifestyle, so I really try to concentrate on designing this first international ocean station. But of course, my mind cannot remain into this only aspect of this research device, and of course I'm thinking of implementation on them and stuff. So I think it's a constant dialogue. So for example, we have a research called the Live Cable, which is a laboratory trying to put the water, the clean water and the wastewater, the information, so maybe fiber and electricity and maybe some data into one single cable. And I think that I'll start doing some testing this winter at the same time as I'm building the small floating laboratory. So we can't really dissociate the research we do. I mean, because we're doing the research on land most of the time, we're preparing it on land. Mm-hmm. So I think that the innovation will just sprout naturally and in the process.
So it's sort of a propagation of the component technologies and as opposed to the big vision piece of it.
Definitely. I mean, if you want to make a plane, you cannot think only about the whole structure. You really have to think of all the detail and the small mechanics and that takes sometimes a very long time, and people don't really value that that detailed research. But that's probably where the success of a big project resides. It's really in those details, I guess.
If I can interject for a second and maybe ask Kathy's question a slightly different way. From the space program, we had mostly technological byproducts. The transistor and a whole bunch of other things came out of some of the space mm-hmm. research. But there was no way for the average person to go into space. Only very few people went into space, and there wasn't a whole new civilization started out there, at least not yet. And I think Kathy's saying, if this really catches on, there could be many, many people living this lifestyle, and they'd be outside of national jurisdictions probably, and mm-hmm. it would create new ways of living and so forth. Would there be some sort of social contagion or feedback of what they learn and what they do? And then clearly we have no way of knowing right now, but Kathy, I think that's sort of where you were heading, right?
I understand. So I agree with you. So there might be offshoots and, like you're saying, like a byproduct or shoot of the permaculture and other stuff. But again, that's really not what the open setting wants to focus on. We really want to make this pure artifact that really works. And then other groups like the Seasteading Institute or Rastify, or other group will probably focus more on the lifestyle and disseminating these technologies
yep.
and making them more. But we really want to be at the forefront of this research, and we really focus on this more research aspect and exploration than the lifestyle.
Gary, if I could ask one more question.
Please ask as many as you'd like.
I'm just, because we're future-oriented people at the Institute and always looking out 10 years or something like that, if we were to project out, say, let's say 20 years, and we look out into the future 20 years, and we say that this project that you're engaged in, the International Ocean Station, open sailing, has been an incredible success, what do you think is different in 2020, what does that success look like, and what are people saying about what you've accomplished?
I think, like you said, there's a lot of small pieces of technology that we may find on the way that will be disseminated to propagate, like you said as well, in the society. So same, like Jerry was saying, we have this aerogel and we have all this cool solar panel technology so I think the strongest thing that we can do in 20 years to think reasonably is to have less of this research, having more like a daily life applications. And of course, ideally in 20 years we will have several of these international ocean stations floating in many different locations of the ocean and doing effective research and being very precise indicators of climate change and eutrophication of the oceans, or giving us clues of how to resolve the problem of dead seas and acidification and, overfishing and all these major issues for food, for the food crisis that is coming. And so I hope we can contribute to all these problems we have to face.
Excellent.
So one thing that might happen is if this really succeeds, we might have a lot more respect for the ocean, and it might accelerate our attempts so far to rein in overfishing and overpolluting and so forth in different ways.
The thing is, it's very difficult to like today we have boats and we're only able to like go out and do one day testing, and then we come back maybe 2 years afterwards and we make another measurements, and you know. Like what we get, the more precise statistics we get is how many tons of fish the fishermen are getting out of the nets. But you know, there's a lot of bycatch as well. They just throw out back in the water, and it's so difficult to quantify what is our impact on the ocean right now, because we don't have these structures. So if we have these structures, like it would give a huge progress for how we could study all these indicators.
Interesting. Jemaine, David, if you want to ask questions, hit star one on your phone to get a cue, unless if you speak, we hear you. So I think star one, and in fact, for anybody who's on the call, hitting star one will actually put you in the queue for a question.
I mean, about the respect, yes. Also, I think, of course, the respect is an important part. Like, you can only respect something that you know. Like, if you don't know something, you usually fear it. And that's what's happening with the ocean. I mean, I'm half Japanese, half French, and in Japanese culture, the ocean has always been a source of fear. Like, Japanese people don't have a culture of a tradition of fear of the ocean, because of tsunami. We've been hit by so many tsunami because of the seismic nature of the region. So yes, definitely, if we can raise respect and knowledge for the ocean, that would be a big contribution. Like National Geographic already does so much, just to give a detailed and beautiful image and complex understanding of the ocean.
It's funny. I was just reading about a South Pacific Islander who I think has recently died, who may be the last person who knew how to navigate just by watching the wave action and the stars and everything else. And there's kind of a very ancient tradition of navigating over very long distances across the Pacific from island to island and with great accuracy. And being able to read from the wave action how close you are to land, and also from evidence like, you know, land-based birds flying by and so forth, but really subtle and beautiful natural skills that are being lost as well, that might be revived for some of this, although these days we have GPS systems. So
the Polynesians are really exceptional people. Like, if you look at the architecture of their boats, like most of their boats have this cell called prau. And they have flexible hulls, so they have they have really small, very lightweight boats, and there's no boat faster on the ocean than theirs, except the really new high-tech stuff. But their traditional boats are incredible. They take huge waves, and they elegantly just bounce and flex in the waves. They're just an amazing source of inspiration instead of making these really big static metallic hollow shells that get broken with the big first rogue wave, we need to learn from these lightweight, flexible structures that they beautifully do.
Yep. A different question, which is, what are the barriers that you see going forward? What are the biggest obstacles to making this actually work?
It's a dangerous business if you think about it. Like the most dangerous work, the most dangerous profession today is the fisherman. So after occupational health reports, people dying at work, most of the people dying at work are fishermen. So the fisherman today is the most dangerous work for the human society, and that reflects how unpredictable the sea is.
Oh, can you hear me? This is David Harris.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, we can hear you.
Wow, okay, great. Well, I missed a few minutes there. I'm not sure if you touched on this, but I had an interesting experience a number of years ago. I went to a place called Biosphere 2 in Arizona. Are you familiar with that place, Cesar?
Yes, sir. I've never been, but I read about it. Yes.
Well, I was just curious about, if other people aren't familiar, it was this experiment in, you know, what it might be like on the human scale to live in an enclosed ecosystem for 3 years, which was sort of estimated to be the time it would take to get to Mars, more or less, I think. Something like that. I'm probably butchering the premise. But in any case, they locked up a bunch of people in there. I think it was maybe a dozen people. And the thing that I found fascinating was the sort of interpersonal stories and the psychology of it, but also, you know, just the idea of trying to farm in an enclosed space. And I know you're not talking about creating an enclosed space in terms of the ecosystem, but I'm curious about the interpersonal aspects, like how many people do you see living in these units? I watched the video on your website, and I didn't get a sense of exactly sort of the population size of these when you start out and how you'll deal with those more sort of interpersonal questions. And will people be kind of on and off of these things on a weekly or a monthly basis, or is this a more long-term, years at a time? And this is, you know, your long-term thinking about this.
So this is a very important question. The psychology aspect is very important. I think the ocean station is much less challenging, and we're going to have much more procedural and progressive way of getting into this big problems, because if we the first ocean station that we might build might be not very far from the shore, so we might be able to restock the fresh food like every week for the scientists who will be on board, and they may be able to come back if not every day, but from time to time if we're close enough from the shore. I mean, it really depends on the experiments we're doing. So I think it's going to be mostly driven by what kind of observation we want to do. So if, for example, in the best case, because I mean, it's just planned right now. So if we say the first floating laboratory we managed to build it for this this winter, then in the Gulf of Mexico, then probably we're able to go every day or to go to stay there just for 3 days, and maybe two or three people will be on board. So it's not, I think it's quite easy to deal with. I think we will see this problem step by step, and the people will be trained as well as the time goes by.
So can you foresee a situation where you actually get to, you know, hundreds of people living in one of these things, or children growing up entirely on one, or is that not actually part of your intent?
I would say that it's not part of what I would advocate, or what not the stuff that I'll be talking right now, because I think this is too far. I mean, as a project leader, when you want to achieve something complex, you don't want to scare people off and say it's going to do this and this and this and this. You want to say, okay, we have this problem. How can we solve this? And you're trying to simplify. You're trying to make it, you're trying to make it affordable. You're trying to make it safe, and of course, you're trying to make it do what it's supposed to do. So the research and the study of the ocean or environment sensing. So even though, of course, I'm thinking about that stuff, I don't want to scare people off and say, okay, look, we're going to be in the middle of the Pacific and you won't have food for 3 months. Because, I mean, this is too far. If I say this, everybody will be scared, and there's no point, because I myself, I don't know how to deal with it yet. We have to answer these questions together.
Yeah, I don't think you'd get very many volunteers to be trash pickers in the Pacific Gyre, out in the middle of nowhere trying to find something valuable and, from the scraps that are out there. But I appreciate, David, I really appreciate the framing, because it draws a stark contrast between this idea of trying to emulate a mission to Mars, where clearly you're in a capsule and you're not going to have any contact, with edging your way, easing your way into living on the water, and you do that by staying close to shore at the beginning. I actually hadn't thought that far through this.
I mean, if you want to be a great runner, and you want to run a marathon, you're not going to start training running 40 kilometers tomorrow. You're going to first, you need to make sure you can run. I mean, I haven't run in a long time, so I would just maybe do 2-3 kilometers, and then maybe the next. Just step by step, you improve, and if you discover on the way that you cannot stay 3 months, but you can stay 2 months, well, that's great already. Then you will shape your research according to your capacity. You want to be reasonable and not take crazy risks. You want to be in control of what you do.
I think that sounds like a very responsible position to take, and probably by taking that, you'll avoid a lot of the traumas that occurred with the people at Biosphere 2 as well.
I don't know how they train, but I can imagine if they stayed 1 week, you know, like before they actually sign up completely, or, you know, just minimizing the risk, really, and have a more humble approach to problem solving. It's just, you know, iterative and progressive.
Yeah, I don't know how they trained or how they started, but I just remember hearing stories of the rationing out of coffee. There was, at a certain point, there just wasn't enough coffee for everyone, and they had to take turns who would get a cup of coffee each morning. And you know, these stories of not having enough rice or not having enough food, and that leading to sort of deep interpersonal conflicts, and you know, a couple coming in married at the beginning and, you know, at the brink of divorce by the end. So it's a good idea to not get into those conflicts. People could be, you know, a bigger obstacle than you imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine very, very much this kind of thing today being like a reality TV.
Exactly.
So I really want to avoid this and dropping people and just like breaking lives. That's really the opposite of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, you want to avoid the reality TV show based on this. That's probably a good point. Although from an experimental laboratory perspective, if they're willing to not have the drama, which runs counter to all the reality TV instincts, right? It would be a really interesting thing to watch over time, and you could in fact track so much of this and be open and public and have video feeds such that there would be a self-assembled reality show out the other end. But one of the things I think happened in the Biosphere project is that they started having very high levels of CO2 dangerously. They had a spike in CO2 that they couldn't quite figure out, and that was actually more life-threatening than who was going to get coffee in the morning.
Yeah.
I think Jason Tester's on the line. Let me see if hitting the magic.
Hi, this is Jume Castro, actually.
Oh, it's Jume. Okay, good.
Well, actually, David asked the one iteration of the question I was going to ask, so let me take a different tack, take a different topic. To what degree do you imagine that there would be, you'd be using remotely operated vehicles or, you know, the semi-autonomous robots and such in the operations of the station?
Okay, so in ocean exploration, if you look out there and if you look at the presentation of like eminent professors, the very big trend right now is to do everything remotely. So you have ROVs, so remotely operated vehicles, under the water, on the surface of the water. But, you know, basically these missions are very expensive and there's many things that they cannot do. If you want to carry complex tasks of manipulation and a lot of the sampling of especially extractive materials like oil, which is very sticky and, you know, clogs the sensor really quickly and stuff like that. So there's lots of stuff we need humans. So if you look at like a typical like underwater drone, maybe it costs $50,000 for one sensing unit. But maybe you could do this sensing with people much more cheaply, just from the surface. They could, you know, take out samples and then look at the samples. They can analyze and then take a decision for what's the next step. There's a lot of great progress in the remote study, and we hope to contribute on the more like inhabited study, basically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jimmy. And let me try and is Jason on the line as well?
I am. Hello. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Hello. Hi, this is Jason from ISTF. I've been spending a lot of time, immersed off the coast of Somalia and in Somali piracy.
Yes.
And I'm realizing that a lot of these lightweight technologies for staying on the ocean, for being able to have a longer-term presence at sea, could really change the tide in Somali piracy, either for the pirates or for the Navy. I mean, so much of the situation has been caused by the destruction of fisheries, by illegal fishing, by toxic dumping, and you know, piracy even started by Somalis kind of forming their own Navy to protect their fisheries. And they're starting to move farther away from the coast by using kind of motherships that allow smaller ships to go out, pirate, and then come back. So they're extending their range already by kind of having a semi-permanent base at sea. I wonder if you thought about the almost kind of the political implications of some of these technologies being used in coastal political hotspots.
Okay, so that's a very, very good question. So one of the first places we went for inquiring where we could build this International Ocean Station is actually the south, the coast of Morocco. So just to see if it was possible to build this machine at a low cost, we went to Morocco, so the city of Al Jadida, which is a big harbor, construction harbor. And so we were looking at how much it would cost to build this first prototype of the International Ocean Station in these waters, because there's a heavy industrialization happening right there at the moment, and the fishery situation is not very, very stable. And also, in this very small stretch of water from the coast of Al Jadida, there are hundreds of illegal immigrants. So basically going to these rafts and crossing from the African continent to the European islands of the Canary Islands. So every year, there are hundreds of illegal immigrants who are dying in this very small stretch of water. So one of the first applications we thought of the International Ocean Station, of course, was like observance of how these flows of illegal immigrants are flowing, and maybe how we could help them by having this kind of floating structure just for life-saving. Also because the first place where we went for structural engineering research, we went to study at the Centre d'études et de la pratique de la survie. So it's the center for the study and the practice of survival technologies in the submarine bases of Lorient. It's in France, and this is where they build submarines and also life rafts. So this is a life raft test center. So the structure itself of the International Ocean Station is very inspired by life rafts and this kind of life-saving technology. And the political implication could be like helping and life-saving like illegal immigrants. So that's another aspect of the project.
Mm-hmm.
So apart from this about piracy, yes, of course, if you have a floating structure with a lot of expensive equipment, you're very likely to be attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we protect ourselves? So of course we're a Pacific organization. We're not going to have weapons on board or anything like this. We're here for making research. And so, we already have the problem. Like, if we want to put the equipment for environmental sensing in the Gulf of Mexico, many other companies, environmental companies who are paid by BP have been, doing environmental research and sensing, and they're giving reports saying that, oh, the oil is all gone, and, So if we're making some environmental report and we say, no, the oil is still here, and hundreds of animals are dying in the bottom of the ocean, we don't see them, and that's the case. So many people would like to destroy our equipment. So we already have the problem of piracy, not from pirates, but maybe from other organizations. So the design has to be not only waterproof, but really pirate-proof, indeed.
Wow. Yeah. Just as a side note on this notion of life rafts and life at sea, there's a really interesting book called Lifeboat by John Silgo, who's a historian at Harvard. And he goes through the historic design of lifeboats and a bunch of other things, because it turned out that lifeboats have been very poorly designed for years and years and years and years, and nobody studied it. And also he talks about the psychology of a small group isolated in lifeboats. And he makes a really interesting point way up front, that when the age of sail died and was replaced by the age of steam, and we had craft that could just go anywhere, that didn't have to worry about sails and wind, that survivability at sea went down, because the chances that there was a sailor on board your lifeboat who knew whether you should try to go upwind toward the island you just thought you saw, or go 1,500 miles downwind and use the currents to get to another island, that sailor probably didn't know anything about sailing anymore. Very, really interesting stuff just about native knowledge and use of nature.
Yeah, when you get close to an island, well, depending on the direction of the wind, but sometimes the waves get shorter because the bottom is shallower, so the waves have a tendency to have a shorter frequency or periods and a bigger amplitude, because you know when you get close to the shore, the waves become higher and faster and more violent. So sometimes you have this fake hope that you get closer to an island, but actually it gets worse. So like you said, we need to have a lot of knowledge in addition to a good structure and good construction.
Exactly. We are nearing the end of our call, and I wanted to offer you a moment to say whatever came up in your mind during our call that you wish you had had time to say, or something that you think we should pay more attention to as closing thoughts, and then I will summarize what we've covered and take us out.
What do you think, this is an open question to whoever is in the audience, is what in your mind is excited when you hear about the International Ocean Station, like how do you see yourself participating in such endeavors?
So how would people like to participate, or what sounds exciting about it?
Yeah, what excites you in it, and how do you think that people could get involved into this?
Those are great questions. Can we tell people how to get a hold of you? Do you want to say your email address here?
Okay, so we have this website called Open Sailing. So it's opensailinginoneword.net. But my question was more, some people might be, excited to do, some people are excited because of their environmental studies, some people are excited because of the sailing, some people are excited about the lifestyle. Can I ask to the crowd, like, what do they think they found attractive in this research or project?
Yes, so let me see if anybody's actually in the queue. So there's nobody. If anybody has a statement, I think I'm slowly learning how to use the conference system properly. Sorry. So star one puts you in the queue. If somebody wants to say something about that, a star one puts you in the queue, and then I can take people out. But I think that this might be a hard question to ask given our current format.
Oh, see. So maybe what the people are still skeptical about. I mean, what are people afraid of? What do they think will save?
Well, I think the questions are great. I think our conference call format makes it difficult to ask that question and have people come through. Let me see if there's another question.
Hey,
another question.
In terms of what we like the best, this is David Harris again, by the way. I love the animation that you did on your website where you compare the ecosystem effects of like a cruise ship, or I'm not sure exactly what kind of boat that is, but, with toxic paint on the outsides of it and just sort of hermetically sealed and trying to, moving through the ocean, destroying everything around it, to, the idea of this nomadic ecosystem that you're creating. And I think that narrative of a human presence in the ocean that is actually, participating in the ecosystem in a really conscientious way and following the logic of the ecosystem itself is, it's really compelling. And I think that's something that would draw me and into this and also pique the interest of others.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
So maybe that's more the biology. So maybe that's the interest on the biology research aspect that would be, I mean, if you're participating, that's probably the aspect that you'd be more interested in. How do you actually make life thrive and collect just a part of what you can, enhance in the ocean?
I think it's also maybe a subtle notion about living with the ocean rather than merely living on the ocean.
Yeah, no, off the ocean. That's correct. The whole design of the structure is really made so you're not like breaking the waves. You're really moving with the waves. Like the half of the structure ideally would be made just of passive water, so that's really the idea is really not to invent this indestructible structure, but rather this flexible structure that moves with the waves and rather than opposing.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I think that to the extent that this is about creating a new human relationship with oceans, as opposed to finding a new place that people can conquer. Then it gets more and more exciting. I mean, all we hear today about oceans is how we're destroying them, and presenting this as in that light of preserving and really a partnership ethic with nature, sort of grounded in the deep ecological thinking. I think, which it seems like you are. I think that makes it much more exciting.
I think the main reason for this is because of my ancestry. I mean, even if I was raised in Europe, my father is Japanese and I'm Shinto, so my religion is Shinto. And Shinto is the idea that everything is alive, so that we have to respect machines as well as a leaf or a hamburger or a penguin or a cloud. Like, everything is alive, so we have to kind of deal with everything with respect. And so that's maybe where, like, what you guys identify as deep ecology thinking comes from. It's really traditional animist beliefs.
Mm-hmm. So okay. Let me go through and summarize what we've covered. And let's see. We started with Sesab telling us the birth story of these groups. And it started really personally for him that he's always been passionate about sailing. And even when he worked on unrelated projects, they always ended up somehow in the water. Then a small group of people at the Royal College of Art in London started thinking about this. They were actually working on a project around mind control and the politics of fear, and turned that whole thing around to figure out how to use fear to help people do something good. And where would a viable, safe place to live be? And this turned out to be the sea. And this turned into the ocean, the International Ocean Station project as part of it. And we talked a bit about safety in the ocean, about the notion that there's waves and winds and wind and weather, and it tends to be difficult to be out there. So you have to worry about purification, nutrition, energy, all those kinds of things. But it turns out that a lot of research projects have figured these many different things out in different ways, but nobody so far is really bringing them together to create a gentle way to live on the sea. So, you know, and why would you want to live on the sea, not just to sort of be there for just no reason whatsoever? So the project here, Open Sailing, turned into a research and exploration project on the ocean, really a nonprofit flagship with a social framework to figure out how to conquer these questions openly together. And the International Ocean Station is a project of Open Sailing and is modeled roughly on the International Space Station, although later in the call we came up with really interesting ideas about, well, it's not like space travel because you could actually start gently by being right offshore. And you could fly back and forth. You wouldn't have a lot of the same problems that David Evan Harris brought up a little later in the call about the Biosphere Project, for example. We talked very briefly about Sarah Jane Pell and some of her work, which is similar to what Cesar is doing, but hers is mostly underwater. She is a commercial scuba diver and also an artist who does a lot of things underwater. So openness has been really interesting here because a lot of the ocean engineering is really our next frontier. And one of Cesar's mentors was a chief welder for the Moon project and was really saying, look, the ocean is the next frontier. Space in some weird way is easier. It's cold, it's empty, and it's predictable. Water is complex, wilder. Water weighs a lot. So when it hits you and moves you around, you can't actually conquer it. You have to study it and learn to live with it peacefully in different ways. The open structure of the project lets more people participate here, and really they're not emphasizing the lifestyle at all. It's a little bit like in aviation. You don't want to have everybody living in the clouds. We really need to learn, do we have an aircraft? How do we live? To move slowly into this world in baby steps. You don't, as Sissab said earlier, you don't run a marathon immediately. First you figure out, do you run well? Can you run better? And then you work your way up in distance. So that's really what's nice about this project is that it's very easy to explore and experiment, even with scale models, as you'll see from some of the videos on Sissab's blog. So they're taking a very pragmatic approach, starting with a biological framework of the six basic functions of biological entities. They can sense, move, excrete, reproduce, communicate, and so forth. And, you know, how do we create instinctive architecture that creates shapes that are ocean steady but able to move around, as opposed to large ocean platforms that use a lot of technology to stay in one place, such as the Deepwater Horizon that just went down in the Gulf and a couple others that are actually in some sort of trouble. How do you create drifting structures that can shrink in or reef themselves in when bad weather approaches so that they're not so exposed to danger, and then redeploy themselves when the weather is great, and use the motion of all that water and wind and sun as energy? So how do you adapt rather than resist the environment? You also need, in the middle of all this, to make the life spacing, the living spaces, stable. So you find stable structures like spheres and sticks, which, because they have the same wet surface presented to the water, tend to be more stable than other surfaces. And if you weight them at the bottom, have stability. So it's sort of like the way that a bellboy works in the water. And these things can sort of absorb, not only absorb beatings, but in many cases turn them into energy. Also, if you create sort of a series of consecutive shells, kind of like a Russian doll. Some of those shells can be designed to compress and absorb energy while they, in fact, power turbines. And then they can reinflate back or regenerate their original space and then do the same thing again. There's a couple projects here that they're working with in this tinkering culture method. One of them is called Energy Animal, which is a device that floats in the water or underwater and actually can generate energy from wind action, sunlight, and wave action. So they've got a prototype that they've actually tested, and it's not generating a lot more energy than it takes to move and maneuver, but it's actually a really great first design stage. And Cesar points out that, look, it took 25 years to really design the International Space Station and over $150 billion from many different countries. By open sourcing this, it seems like we can get a lot more done in a lot sooner for a lot less. So really, and part of what I learned in the last couple of days at Singularity University was that we've moved into an era of design, build, test, as opposed to hypothesize, work through the logic of it, and then maybe think about prototyping something. You can actually go directly to design, build, and then see if it works. CISA is working in the Gulf of Mexico right now, partly because of the oil spill, and also hope to float something into the Gulf that is a part of ocean sailing by the end of this year. We talked very briefly about Spiral Island, where a fellow took some plastic bottles, sealed them up with air inside, and then started building dirt and mangroves and other kinds of vines on top and created this island that he lived on for several years as being very inspiring. And also the parallels here with permaculture. In some sense, we're creating an aqua permaculture. Kathy Vian said, look, if this is successful, how does it feed back to land life? And a lot of what CISA sees happening is technologies that work in the sea coming back and being useful for land life. So another project like Energy Animal is the Life Cable, which is a research project to build a single cable that can bring clean water in, take waste products out, do data connections and power and so forth, all in one cable that is really weatherproof and waterproof and so forth. They look like they'll be testing that this winter. So he thinks that there will be a propagation of these component technologies back into society in different ways. And really, his project is not focusing on the cultural aspects. And a lot of these technologies may eventually become ubiquitous. Another effect might be that we'll have a lot more respect for the oceans, that we'll understand about overfishing and pollution in a different way, at a different level than we do today. Cesar made a really interesting observation that you can only respect something that you know, and that Japan, for instance, has a culture where the ocean there is about fear. They fear the tsunamis and the danger that the ocean can bring, in contrast to South Pacific Islanders, for example, who see the ocean as something that they can, in fact, navigate by learning how to read the waves and how to be instinctually on the ocean. So it's really about changing people's perceptions and fears here. Fishing is the most dangerous work on Earth, pretty much. It's among the most dangerous occupations. Huge container ships sink all the time. There are occasional super waves reported in the oceans. So this is really a serious project, and CESA is not trying to get people to climb on board some craft and go live permanently way out in the middle of the ocean. This is going to be taken a step at a time. David Evan Harris jumped in and talked about Biosphere 2, this project where people were locked into a biosphere for 3 years in Arizona, sort of an emulation of what it would be like to be together for the length of time it might take to get to Mars, and really talked about the psychology of it also. And that's where we got into this interesting note about that this is not meant to be an enclosed system, and in fact, the fact that it isn't and the fact that you can take small steps makes it really a really interesting thing to test and prototype in different ways. So you could begin by building an International Ocean Station not far offshore, so you could easily restock when you run out of things. Anybody could travel back and forth whenever they wanted to. Think about, you know, how people get to and from those drilling rigs that are in the Gulf at this point. They travel in and out by boat and helicopter all the time. So you could make it affordable and safe, and that really is the priority here. Jaime Cassio asked about remote-operated vehicles and semi-autonomous robots and what role they might play. And they factor into some of the inspirations here, remote-operated vehicles, being very useful underwater, but they're very expensive and they can actually be limiting in certain ways. And there are some tasks that require a lot of manipulation or extraction. For instance, if you're working with crude that has escaped into the ocean, into the Gulf, it's very sticky and it requires a lot of human intervention. So in this case, it's probably going to be cheaper to do things from the surface in many ways. Jason Tester has been doing a lot of research into the Somali pirate situation and has a notion that lightweight technologies for living on the sea might change the balance of power in different ways, both for the pirates and for the Navy. And also he's been looking into the reasons for the Somali navies being created to protect fisheries and the dumping of very toxic things on the Somali coast and so forth, and their use of motherships to extend the range of these raiders. So there's a lot of really interesting dynamics there. And Sessa said, oh, very interesting. We've been studying, doing some work off the coast of Morocco and maybe building our initial station around there. There happens to be a thin strip of water that's really quite dangerous for a lot of immigrants trying to get onto European, onto Spanish territory in the Canary Islands or Ceuta, several other islands off the coast of Morocco are dying just trying to get out there from the local ports. So there may actually be some nifty work to do there. They're also working, the Open Sailing is also working with the Center for Study and Practice of Survival Technologies in France, which studies life rafts and submarines and living at sea in different ways. So there's lots of ways to get better data and create private proofs for things that are happening. So, for example, what are, in fact, the effects of the deep water pollution in the Gulf at this point? So Seth is wondering from all of us, what is exciting about this project and how would we like to participate? So go to opensailing.net if you'd like to read more and participate. David jumped back into the conversation and said he really enjoyed the animation created comparing the ecosystem effects of living lightly on the water with the large ships, sealed containers basically, that really treat the ocean just as a road. In different ways. And I think what we're talking about here is living with the ocean, not on the ocean, and not creating things that are indestructible, but rather things that are adaptable. And to close, and this is a very nice closing note, I think, Sessa pointed to his own family legacy, which is also a lot of blend of Shintoism, where it's a very animist tradition where everything is alive and it means respect for things, for nature, even for machines in different ways. We've been talking with Cesar Harada about living on the oceans in this fifth FutureCast call held on August 12, 2010. Cesar, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And everybody else, thank you also for joining us. Please feel free to tell others about these calls and to tell us how to make them better. We are open for ideas. For IFTF, I'm Jerry Mikulski. We'll talk to you on the next call. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of FutureCast, IFTF's ongoing podcast series. We publish these shows under the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can learn more at our website at iftf.org.